It is Monday, August the 17th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Coming up, Syrian airstrikes in a country already up against the wall.
It is a humanitarian disaster. It really boggles the mind, especially given that Syria, despite years of autocratic rule, was considered one of the more stable countries in the region.
Also ahead, South Sudan's civil war and the search for peace, plus China's currency crunch. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights says at least 80 people were killed in Syria on Sunday in Syrian government airstrikes in the rebel-held town of Duma near Nabaskus. Attacks on a market wounded hundreds more, mainly civilians. Opposition fighters in Duma have regularly traded fire with the Syrian military during the country's civil war, which is now in its fifth year. Conflict has killed an estimated 250,000 people since it began in 2011. Although Syrian airstrikes got an almost immediate condemnation from Amnesty International, which called the strikes a war crime. And for some perspective on all of this, VOA's Victor Beatty speaks with University of San Francisco international relations scholar Stephen Zunis, asking him why the Syrians appear to have targeted civilians with these airstrikes.
Well, much of the world's attention has been on ISIS and the horrific atrocities in areas they control. The Syrian regime has continued perpetrating atrocities on rebel-held territories. The scene of this latest attack, a northeastern suburb of Damascus, has been a rebel stronghold for some time now. Indeed, back during the nonviolent, the peaceful pro-democracy phase of the uprising, Duma was a center of the unarmed resistance to the regime. Amnesty International, well, very critical, of course, of this latest massacre, has also criticized the rebels based in that town for lobbing rockets into civilian areas of Damascus. But as we saw in last year's war between Hamas and Israel, the government side was able to inflict far more damage in terms of the civilian population.
Stephen, the Associated Press is saying that fighting in and around Damascus has escalated in recent days. Last week, rebels shelled the capital ahead of a visit by Iran's foreign minister, killing more than 30. What's going on around Damascus?
The opposition to the Assad regime has not abated, and there have been increasing efforts by both secular and Islamist forces to advance against both the regime and against each other. The government, while gaining some ground in some parts of the country, has been losing it in others. It's a seesaw battle, but the main victims, unfortunately, have been civilians.
There now is a report that close to 12 million people have been uprooted by the conflict in Syria, with more than 4 million refugees, another 7.5 million displaced internally. This is a catastrophe of enormous proportions.
It is a humanitarian disaster. It really boggles the mind, especially given that Syria, despite years of autocratic rule, was considered one of the more stable countries in the region. When the regime cracked down brutally on the nonviolent movement, there were those who rationalize that, oh, we need to take up arms to protect ourselves and to prevent this kind of killing. But, of course, the slaughter has increased exponentially since the opposition took up arms, and they seem no closer to toppling the Assad regime.
Sunday's air raids on Duma came as the new UN humanitarian chief, Stephen O'Brien, held talks with government officials in Damascus on his first trip to Syria since being appointed. How likely are the prospects for peace in Syria given this kind of violence?
There's so much anger, so much resentment, so much bitterness in this badly divided society that it's very hard to see how there could be a peace, especially when you have arms flowing in from the outside to both the government and to various factions. At the same time, it's becoming increasingly obvious that no side can win a military victory. So it's possible that this hurting stalemate could lead some of the more responsible parties to actually come to the negotiating table and try to work something out. One hopeful sign is that with the nuclear deal between Iran and the six powers representing the United Nations, ending that country's isolation, it could enable Iran to play a more productive role. Thus far, they have been supporting the Assad regime, but the more pragmatic forces in Iran, which seem to be gaining ascendancy, might end up encouraging their ally in Damascus to make some of the necessary compromises for peace.
Stephen Zunis is an international relations scholar at the University of San Francisco. He's also author of the book Tinderbox, U.S. Middle East Policy and the Roots of Terrorism. He was speaking with my colleague Victor Beatty. Still ahead on VOA's International Edition, Seeking Peace for South Sudan. This is VOA.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
The lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat.
The African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct.
And adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on The Voice of America. Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time.
With David Bandy.
This is VOA's International Edition. In the face of today's internationally set deadline, South Sudan's President Salva Kiir is in Ethiopia, there to take part in regional mediation aimed at ending the country's 20-month civil war that's killed thousands and displaced hundreds of thousands. Mr. Kiir was reluctant to take direct part in the talks amid a split in the ranks of rebel forces led by the former Vice President Riek Machar. The makeup of the rebel delegation remains unclear, though, less than 2 weeks after two rebel generals said they were no longer allied with Machar. But Machar, who has been in the city for several days, told VOA he will participate in the negotiations with the leaders of Kenya, Uganda, Ethiopia, and Sudan at the regional summit. The current round of talks began on August the 6th under the auspices of IGAD, that's the Regional Intergovernmental Authority on Development, as well as China, Britain, Norway, the U.S., UN, and African Union. Main obstacle is power sharing right now. In Addis Ababa last month, President Obama repeated his call for an end to the conflict in South Sudan. Arab League is set to hold an emergency meeting Tuesday at the request of Libya's internationally recognized government, which is under attack by the Islamic State militants. The Tobruk-based government asked for help from regional allies late Saturday, including airstrikes. The request follows dozens of deaths last week in the coastal city of Sirte, where a group that included local residents attacked IS fighters. Presence of IS fighters adds to what was already a country stricken by internal violence, with rival militia and two governments, one in Tobruk, the other in Tripoli, vying for control. Efforts to rebuild that state following the overthrow and death of longtime leader Muammar Gaddafi nearly 4 years ago in Sirte have not lasted, despite repeated UN attempts to broker a peace deal. African Union has warned that the political crisis in Burundi could have catastrophic consequences for the country and the surrounding region as well. The statement by AU Commission Chief Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuna comes a day after the killing of former military chief Jean Biko Magu. Unidentified gunmen killed Biko Magu outside his home in the capital Bujumbura. Death follows a recent assassination of the president's security advisor, Adolphe Nshimirimana. Well, the country has been rocked by violence since April when President Pierre Nkurunziza announced plans to run for a third term in office. His decision triggered a failed coup in June and clashes that left more than 100 people dead. Critics are saying that Nkurunziza's actions undermine the Constitution and the Arusha Accord, which effectively ended the country's 13-year civil war. Burundi's Constitutional Court ruled he was eligible to run because he was first elected by parliament, not voters, in 2005. The July 21st vote, in which Nkurunziza was reelected, was widely viewed as flawed. Leader of the Nigerian insurgent group Boko Haram insists he is alive and still leader, denying reports that he's dead. In an 8-minute audio message in Hausa released on a social media website Sunday, a person claiming to be Abubakar Shekau dismissed claims by Chad's president, Idris Deby, that he had been replaced. The recording was released by the site intelligence group. Shekau's absence from previous videos fueled speculation he might have been killed or wounded. Nigerian military has claimed to have killed Shekau. And experts are saying a plan to reform tax collection in the Democratic Republic of Congo could help plug massive leaks in the system, but the reform is complicated by the recent creation of 21 new provinces. We get more now from Nick Long in Goma.
The DRC loses around $15 billion a year in uncollected revenue, according to President Joseph Kabila's anti-corruption advisor. Tax collection is particularly poor at the local government level. In Kasai Central, for example, Provincial Finance Minister William Kazumba says the government is only collecting between 10 and 20% of what's due. A new automated system could help close that gap, he says. In the future, tax collectors will print off receipts for taxpayers from their computers, or if they're working outside of the office, from handheld machines.
Quand il rentre, on peut sortir une bande avec tout ce que lui a perçu comme argent et a donné.
When the agent gets back to the office, says Kazumba, the machine will show what he has collected and the receipts he has given, and that will prevent the agent from handing over less than he has collected because it can be checked. But local politician Jim Mukenge of the opposition UDPS party does not think the system will work.
The agents who are going around trying people to pay their taxes will use the old system. They go to a store, get a cut, and they go put the other money into the system.
And Minister Kazumba agrees that computers or automated devices won't necessarily cut out fraud. We can't leave everything to the machine, he says, because the machine is handled by a man. And if the man is corrupt, he will put in false data. The machine can't contradict him, says Kazumba. It can't say, no, what you're telling me isn't true. In theory, the machine could be a block on fraud if what taxpayers should pay is already on the machine. But whether that can be achieved here is still an issue. Nick Long for VOA News, Goma.
Last week, China devalued its currency, which triggered concerns, an international currency war, and raised some fresh questions about the health of the world's second-largest economy. The move had effects on all the global markets. For three consecutive days, the renminbi's value was intentionally lowered. It fell more than 3% before being raised slightly by week's end. And bank officials said the currency was close to trading at market level and dismissed any, as complete nonsense, rumors that Beijing was ready to let the currency's value fall as much as 10%. VOA senior economics correspondent Jim Randall speaks now with my colleague Jim Stevenson, telling him this is the way China seems to manage its currency exchange. And then Jim asked him what might happen this week.
There's two points of view. One is that China and its friends say China is making the currency exchange closer to market forces, and that's true. They take into account yesterday's close, for example, and it is a little more driven by the market, which the United States and the IMF and other people have been urging them to do for a long time. It's a little closer. At the same time, whenever any country, China or any other nation, when their currency becomes weaker, cheaper, products produced in that country or our country or anybody else's country become less expensive on global markets. That gives them a price advantage. And so there's a reason to try to have a weak currency. There are also reasons not to. It hurts you in other ways. Under the profound economic rule, meaning there's no such thing as a free lunch. But in this case, China's many critics say they're just doing it to boost their exports. I think both actually are true, that China is moving in a slightly more market-oriented direction in dealing with their currency. And this move came shortly after some unhappy news for China about their exports. And they're not going nearly as well as they had hoped. And the economy is still very dependent on exports, even though they've been trying very diligently to try to have a more consumption-oriented economy and to have it move more toward services and so forth. That hasn't happened yet.
You know, robust trade has built the Chinese economy to what it is over the past many years, but people are buying differently now than they used to. Countries are not buying perhaps as many Chinese goods as they are from other countries.
Well, one of the things that's happened is that China's economy is maturing, as all of everybody's economy does gradually. And what was once seen as a more or less inexhaustible supply of labor has become finite. And workers with appropriate skills are demanding higher pay, and they're getting it in some cases. And so that's raising China's production costs, which means some of the production that was offshored from the United States or from other advanced nations and ended up in China is now moving past China and going other places. And just costs have gone up a bit. So their exports aren't quite as competitive as they once were.
Similar things happened to Japan in the 1970s, and the production shifted largely to Korea. Now Korea's economy has matured as well. Does China have a lot to learn from its neighbors and what happened to their economies over the past decades?
Well, certainly. And they're it's a pretty astute group of people. I had the privilege of living there for a few years, and I was impressed. A country with enormous potential, enormous problems, and a whole lot of very smart people trying very hard to figure things out, sometimes successfully, sometimes not. But I think you would be foolish to bet against China.
A lot of people would just on the surface immediately say, oh, this is manipulation and that sort of thing. But it goes beyond that, as you mentioned.
Every time I do a story, I discover that the economy is kind of like a Rubik's Cube on steroids. I mean, you change this part and the whole other end of it turns purple or something. And that's certainly true in this case.
Well, certainly all of the colors are in alignment whenever we speak with Jim Randall. Thank you so much, Jim, for your time and thoughts.
Rubik's Cube on steroids. I love it. Many thanks, gentlemen. Now, International Edition's G. Abby Lee joins us to continue our conversation about China's currency devaluation. Hey, G., what's being said now on Twitter about all of this?
Hi, Steve. So people tweet about mostly two issues regarding the yuan devaluation. The first is why the Chinese central bank allowed the yuan to weaken so significantly, and what's next for the currency. Enda Kuran, who reports for Bloomberg, linked one of his articles on Twitter titled Why China Devalued the Yuan. He wrote that one motivation for Beijing is to have the yuan accepted by the IMF into its basket of reserve currencies. That basket contains the U.S. dollar, the euro, the Japanese yen, and the British pound. Another motivation could be making Chinese products cheaper in overseas markets, which could boost the exports. Kuran is based in Hong Kong and is on Twitter at Enda Kuran.
And gee, what about from the Chinese media? Any word from them?
Absolutely no tweets about the yuan devaluation today, at least from the ones that tweet in English. I'm talking about the Xinhua News Agency and the People's Daily China. They are on Twitter at XH News and PD China, respectively.
And gee, what about the Chinese central bank's chief economist saying he expects a two-way volatility in the yuan's value in the future?
Steve, I believe Reuters broke that news. So a two-way volatility means both depreciation and appreciation of the yuan. The comment by Ma Jun is a response to concerns that China's move to weaken its currency could prompt its neighbors to do the same. If the neighboring countries all compete to weaken their currency to lower the price of their exports, that's called a currency war. Steve?
Currency war. Thanks very much, G. That is International Edition's G. Abby Lee. And a reminder, you can follow International Edition on Twitter. You can find us at VOA_IE. Still ahead on the program, the latest superstar no one's ever heard of. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
It's tough for male elephant seals to find and attract a female mate during breeding season. It turns out that the competition for a lady elephant seal's attention is pretty stiff. While somewhat rare, very violent, bloody fights do break out between the opponents vying for the affection of a particular female. The male elephant seal mostly likes to make a lot of noise and stir up commotion by arguing and posturing among other rival males to attract a mate. But a new study by researchers at the University of California at Santa Cruz has found that the males also develop a natural form of voice recognition. They learn to recognize the unique call of their adversaries so that they can decide whether they should engage in a brutal fight or avoid confrontation by fleeing. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. You know, behind every great song, there is a songwriter. Well, of course, for decades and throughout the decades, the most successful of these have been very well heard, but lived in relative obscurity. David Byrd and Ray McDonald got together here to talk about the latest superstar you've likely never heard of.
You know his work, but you might not know his name. Max Martin has put the pen to paper and written a slew of number ones. Ray, this guy's got things that he's written. Taylor Swift's Bad Blood. He's also written the current number one song, right?
Can't Feel My Face by The Weeknd. I love talking about this guy because he's such a phenomenon and nobody outside the music industry knows him. Max Martin from Sweden. Can't Feel My Face is his 21st number one single on the Hot 100 as a songwriter. It's his 19th as a producer. Only Lennon and McCartney top him in the songwriter category. And he is second as a producer behind George Martin, who did the Beatles.
'Cause baby, now we got bad blood. You know it used to be mad love. So take a look what you've done. 'Cause baby, now we got bad blood. Hey, now we got problems. And I don't think we can solve them. You made a really deep cut. And baby, now we got bad blood. Hey.
So what other songs has he done that our audience knows about, besides Bad Blood and Can't Feel My Face?
Well, Max Martin started his run of number ones here in the States back in 1999 with Baby One More Time. And he's really caught fire since 2008. 17 of his 19 chart-topping production hits have happened in the past 7 years. And as I say, Can't Feel My Face is his second number one hit of 2015, following Bad Blood.
Does he write these solo, or does he collaborate with people, or both?
He generally collaborates with people. The Weeknd actively collaborated in writing Can't Feel My Face. Generally, Max Martin will do the bulk of the songwriting for his clients, but The Weeknd really insisted on having a bigger say.
Now, is he lyrics and music, or just lyrics, or what?
Well, generally it's lyrics and music, and he started out in Sweden's public music education programs when he was a boy, and he has gone out of his way to thank them for his success. And that's worth noting because in many parts of the United States, these public music programs are either gone or endangered.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, music and arts and, sadly, sports sometimes are the first couple of things to go away.
That's exactly right.
When the emphasis is on what they call STEM, like science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, and getting test scores. But creative arts sometimes is the first thing to suffer. And yet guys like this get their whole life out of a public education. Well, all right, if you have any comments about Max Martin, about some of the tunes he's written, or anything else you hear on our program, you can send us a tweet. We're at VOA _IE. You can also send Ray a tweet at a couple of places. One, at Ray on the Hits, and that's his personal account. And you can also send it to at VOA _music. And if you want to hear Ray count down the top 20 or the top 5 songs every week, log on to www.voanews.com.
Go, Max, go, huh? Cristiano Ronaldo's sister, Katy Aveiro, has launched a Twitter campaign asking fans to back her bid to represent Portugal in the Eurovision Song Contest. Here's Katy singing Latina de Cuerpo y Alma. Soccer star Ronaldo's 38-year-old sibling began her musical career back in 2005 under the stage name Ronalda. Well, how about them apples? Aveiro now wants to sing in the International Music Contest to be hosted by Sweden in May of 2016. She's all over YouTube. You ought to check her out. Cristiano Ronaldo, the youngest of four, plays football for Real Madrid, captains Portugal's national soccer team, and has won the FIFA World Player of the Year 3 times. Super duper for Cristiano and sister Katia. Thanks, everyone, for joining us here on the Voice of America for International Edition. It's always good to have you with us. A reminder, the top world news straight ahead. Hope you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Aiden Utku, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Monday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The global movement to bring Joseph Kony and the Lord's Resistance Army to justice has reached the halls of Congress. More than a dozen members of the U.S. House of Representatives have joined together to introduce a bipartisan resolution condemning Kony and the LRA for continuing to perpetrate crimes against humanity. A similar measure is being considered in the Senate, endorsing current U.S. efforts to support members of the African Union Regional Task Force in hunting down Kony's guerrilla army. It also pledges continued congressional support for U.S. military advisors working with those nations in the region. On August 10th, lawmakers were briefed on efforts to track down and eliminate the LRA and heard testimony from non-governmental organizations that have been working to raise public awareness and assure accountability for atrocities committed by the group. Kony was indicted in 2005 by the International Criminal Court in The Hague, but has evaded capture ever since. For more than 2 decades, his small, ruthless armed band has terrorized large areas of Uganda, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, South Sudan, and Central African Republic, forcing some 465,000 people to flee their homes. Uganda, where the group originated, and its neighboring countries have struggled for years to counter the LRA. With the support of the African Union, the United Nations, the United States, and other international partners, efforts to end the group's depredations against civilians have seriously weakened, but not yet completely eliminated, the group. The congressional action shows once again that our country stands with the governments and the people of Central Africa in their efforts to neutralize the LRA. We call on LRA fighters to put down their arms, leave the organization's ranks, and come home. We will continue to work with the governments in the region to ensure that low-level fighters and abductees who escape from the LRA are able to reunite with their families and reintegrate into normal society.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.